Welcome to this latest edition of the Real Deal Podcast. I'm your host, Surreal Jiro Quinn, recording this on a Wednesday, the first podcast of the month of April. It is remarkable that we already threw a third through the year as we approach the playoffs in both the NBA and NHL. Hope everybody out there is doing well. A lot to get to on this podcast. I'm going to call this podcast the Ladies First Podcast. I'm going to switch it up a little bit. I know we just celebrated Women's Month, the month of March, but guess what? We can just continue it into April as well. You have the Final Four that is set, of course, both the men's and women's, but we've been here before in regards to how much more compelling the women's game has been in terms of the women's tournament has been versus the men's tournament. It's really not even close, to be honest with you. It's not even close this year. And that, you know, you saw an Elite Eight game be the most watched basketball game in the history of women's basketball, women's college basketball, with what transpired on Monday night with LSU. Iowa taking out LSU in the defending champion Tigers. And I expect those numbers to even go up this weekend, despite the fact that, you know, the Final Four is on a Friday, which is one of the worst nights for television, Friday and Saturday as well. So normally if you see your favorite shows on a Friday night or Saturday night, chances are they're going to be going off the air soon. But Sunday, I expect some records to be broken. You know, baseball season just started. The men's championship won't be until Monday. I think it'll do numbers regardless. But I expect the biggest number to come on Sunday with the national championship. But in regards to the women's Final Four, this probably was the best possible Final Four that the women could have gotten. If you're a college basketball fan. You get three heavyweights and one, you know, mini Cinderella. If you want to call it North Carolina State a Cinderella, they are a three seed, but I don't think that they were one of the favorites to win a championship this year. But you're getting, you know, UConn and Iowa is like, that could be a championship. And, you know, we kind of been this year, we really, it's been a year of Caitlin Clark, you know, Angel Reese, South Carolina. UConn is kind of going under the radar this year in terms of the national scene. You know, they are a number three seed. They're a program that at one point in time absolutely owned college basketball. I mean, Gino Auriemma, you know, 11 national championships. They had a stretch where they won like four straight national championships. So, UConn being back in the Final Four, they kind of belong here. Like this, the Final Four is the women's game is right when UConn is at this level. And you're taking on, an Iowa team that is seeking, you know, some redemption coming off what happened last year in the national championship game getting smacked by LSU. They got their revenge last week against LSU. A couple of days ago against LSU, in which was a great game. The first half was tremendous. Second half, LSU just kind of fell apart at the seams. Caitlin Clark did what she does, and that was that. But it makes sense that UConn is here. Like, I'm happy that UConn is here because now, you know, we have the potential for the torch to be snatched in regards to a possible UConn-South Carolina final. If you remember comments that Gino Auriemma made about South Carolina's style of play not too long ago, the physicality of it, he was bothered by it. This is even before all the stuff that he said about the transfer portal. He specifically was calling out South Carolina's style of play because they were kicking his ass. It's just that simple. L. So that would be the final that I want, that frankly I would want to see. Though I won't, excuse me, I will not complain if Caitlin Clark, certainly college basketball and the powers that be want to see Caitlin Clark against South Carolina, like the super player against the super team. But I personally would want to see UConn versus South Carolina. There's a lot on the line with this Final Four. Right now, college basketball, women's college basketball is popping right now. They have a ton of talent. Juju Smith, I know Angel Reese, they're going to lose some talent to the WNBA with Caitlin Clark and, of course, Angel Reese and a couple other players. But they have a number. They have some great talent, some talented players coming back. This is their moment. And they have your women's basketball, especially at the college game, filtering into the WNBA. You have to seize this moment right now. This is your moment. The men are down. It's that simple. I know Connecticut's going for back-to-back championships, but the men's game is down as far as the personalities, as far as the transfer portal, lost up players on the move, coaches on the move, and what have you. Women's is it. The women's game is it right now. And they have an enormous opportunity right now to really go into to go and really take it to another level as far as drawing interest to the game. So I expect this to be a this will be both these games will be somewhat competitive. I think South Carolina is going to handle NC State, to be honest with you. I expect the UConn-Iowa game to be a classic. I mean, you're talking about two dynamic players in Paige Bueckers UConn, and of course Caitlin Clark from Iowa. Listen, in regards to Caitlin Clark, I never, again, I had some criticism of her, not for a game, but the attention that she was getting, not because I didn't think that she was as great as she is, but because I wasn't going to put her at a level of where I'm going to say that she's one of the greatest college basketball players I've ever seen. Now, she goes out there, wins two more games. We had to revisit. We certainly had to revisit that because the college basketball players that I've seen that have been put at this level have won not only one, but multiple championships. Multiple. But as far as her skill goes, that's her skill is undeniable. You're watching that game, and I'll say this. I mean, she's the closest thing that we've ever seen to Steph Curry, even closer than Trae Young, who has been a perennial all-star and who not too long ago signed a Supermax deal. She's close, like she, for what she can do, her range, her ball handling, her playmaking, in a college game, she's unguardable. There's really nothing you can do with her in a college game. Like I'm watching that game, I'm thinking like what from if I'm Kim Mulkey, what do I do? Like how do I guard her? How do I contain her? You're not going to stop her. How can I even slow her down? You could throw double teams. She's going to find an open person. They have a bunch of 3-point shooters. Traps. She's a great ball handler. She finds, I mean, she can, she was going by, you take a bad angle on her, she's at the cup. She's at the cup. So there's really on the college level, there was no way really to defend her. Like there's no way to defend her. I'm almost at the point. I think, to be perfectly honest with you, like I think you just shut everybody else down, and she just gets her 35 to 45 points. I think you just shut everybody else down. The thing that killed South, that killed Iowa, excuse me, that killed LSU in that game. Yeah, Caitlin Clark dominated the game, 41 points, had all-time great performance, but. They had other players that were knocking down threes left and right as well. There was the role there. LSU, Iowa's role players played great in that game as well. So it wasn't just Caitlin Clark by herself. Caitlin Clark by herself. So to me, my thing is, you can score 40, 45 points. We're just going to shut everybody else down, and we're going to limit your assists. You're not going to have 8 to 9 assists. We're going to keep your assists at around 2 to 5. That's to me your best chance at taking Iowa out. Now again, Iowa's not a great team. Like South Carolina, like from in terms of a complete teams, UConn, South Carolina are probably better teams. It's fair. I know South Carolina's a better team. But right now, you have someone who's on a just this tremendous roll. I mean, it's, you know, I know that they are not are probably high. You know, it's kind of like, you know, Danny and the Miracles back in the day. But they're, you know, they obviously they're higher ranked than what Kansas was. I think Kansas was like a six, was a six seed that year, that won the championship. If not lower, I think they were a six seed in 88 when they won the championship. So you get that great player, Glenn Rice with Michigan back in 89. Okay, and Michigan was a one seed. I believe Michigan was a one seed that particular year, or somewhere not lower than three. But you saw Glenn Rice. I mean, you can see we've seen great individual players get hot and lead their teams to championships. Purvis Ellison, 86 with Louisville. So this has the this could be one of those years. This could be one of those years because I frankly didn't think that they were gonna. I thought LSU probably was gonna beat them again. I really did. And we'll get to LSU in a second. But there's nothing you can say about Caitlin Clark's game. Like if you don't like her game or if you have any criticisms about her game, then I don't know what you're watching. Like her, she is a she's gonna be able to, she can get buckets. She's gonna and in WNBA, she will be a top scorer in the WNBA. She will get buckets. Like I don't see I'd be curious to watch the WNBA and see in terms of how teams defend her because you have not seen a player with that type of range ever. With that type of range off the dribble. Like I remember a guy from Arkansas back in the day, Alex Dillard. He was on those teams in 94 and 95, the championship team in 94 and 95. They made it to the they were national runners up for losing to UCLA. But this dude had range similar to that, like 28 to 30 feet easily. But it was a set shot. Like it wasn't off the dribble. It was a set shot. But that's the bet. That's the guy that had that type of range. Chris Jackson, I think, off the dribble probably was close in terms of that range, and he could dribble. He back in the day with LSU, he played with Shaq for a couple of years. So those are like the only of course Steph Curry, but those are the two players. Like Chris Jackson, Lillard did not have range like this coming out of college. He developed his range in the NBA. So Chris Jackson and Alex Dillard, in terms of this type of range that a player has, the only two players I can think of. I don't go as far back as Pete Maravich, so I don't. You know, that's not my generation. That's long before my time. So it should be one great game. South Carolina game. I think NC State, South Carolina. I don't know. I mean, South Carolina hasn't been dominant this year. I think last year their team probably was better last year, and definitely 2 years ago with their championship team. But they're still undefeated. A lot on the line in this Final Four. You have Dawn Staley trying to join a list of coaches to win three or more championships. That includes basically the Mount Rushmore coaches in or Gino Auriemma, Pat Summitt, the late Pat Summitt, Kim Mulkey, and Tara Vanderveer, who all have won three or more championships. Mulkey has four, Summitt has eight, Auriemma has 11, and Vanderveer has three. Vanderveer, of course, is the all-time leader in men's and women's in terms of wins. I think Caitlin Clark, to me, has the most to gain. I don't know how much she has to lose at this point. I feel like if they lost to UConn in a close game, people would be like, well, I guess UConn is on his way back to being a championship program and what have you. If she struggled in that game, I maybe there'll be some criticism, but I guess, you know, I guess her biggest hurdle was Monday night. Like, if she loses back-to-back years to LSU and doesn't even get to the Final Four, coming off a championship appearance, then that's kind of like a step back, and maybe people will quiet down a bit, at least until the WNBA draft, about her play. Now, I if she wins a championship, if she wins two more games, now, I mean, if you think you were annoyed by seeing the coverage on her or the talk about her, it will go to a level. They will be setting ratings records for the WNBA draft. Will do a bigger number than the NBA draft. Like I again, if they Caitlin Clark wins a championship with this team, I promise you the WNBA draft will either equal or do a bigger number than the WN than the NBA draft. That's how much this could go. That's how big this thing could get if she wins a championship. UConn's last championship was 2016. Think about that for a second. You could the women. 2016. Since then, the men have won three championships since then. 14 last year, or two championships. And 14 and last year. Last year. So they've won two championships since UConn's last championship. Listen, Gino talked a lot of shit about South Carolina. He talked a lot of shit. He's going to get his chance. He possibly may get his chance. And if you're South Carolina, you're Dawn Staley. Of course, you're not looking ahead, but you hope if you get by NC State, which I expect they will, you hope it's Connecticut. From a competitive standpoint, Dawn Staley probably wants it to be Connecticut, because what Gene Auriemma said about that program and about South Carolina was completely out of line. It was completely disrespectful. Take your ass whooping, get better, and keep it moving. Pat Summitt, the late and great Pat Summitt, never came at Gene Auriemma like that. And they didn't have the greatest relationship, but it was a competitive. It was, hey, we're challenging. We're at the top of this game. We're challenging. You're pushing our program to be better. When Gene Auriemma, I might have said this on a podcast a ways back, Gene Auriemma won his first championship in 95, right? After years of Tennessee being, the dominant program in college basketball, Pat Summitt did not whine or complain whatsoever. She went back to the lab, and next thing you know, Tennessee wins the championships in 96, 97, and 98. They won three straight. She won three straight championships with Tennessee. So it wasn't okay, we have somebody that can look us eye to eye. I'm going to get better. Didn't complain about physicality. Didn't complain about three-point shooting. Didn't complain about any of the shit that's going on that may have kept her from winning. Kept her, may have, or that any competitive disadvantages that she thought she may have, which I don't think she did. She didn't think there was any competitive disadvantages. But that's the shit that Auriemma said about the South Carolina program. Again, was way over the top, extremely over the top. So it should be fun. Again, this is a big moment for the women's game. Period. College basketball leading into the WNBA. Sticking with the theme of the Ladies First podcast, I must do real thoughts. Early in this podcast, I've had the opportunity to listen to Beyonce's new album, Cowboy Carter, which came out last Friday. Let me preface this by saying this: I respect Beyonce as an artist, as a businesswoman, and what have you. Her longevity, been in the game well over 20 plus years from Star Search up until now. We all know, the accolades and the awards and what have you. I'm not a part of the Beehive. Like, you will never mistake me, anywhere close mistaking me to being a part of the Beehive. And I have not been the biggest fan of Beyonce's albums. From a performance standpoint, she's one of the greatest live performers that we've ever seen. I'm not going to compare her and say she's better than Michael Jackson. I think that's going over the top. But she's up there. Like, she's definitely in the conversation. And one of the great live performers we've ever seen in any genre of music, period. This album is, I'm not going to say it was her best work, but I think eventually over time, we'll probably be calling it her best work. This album is a masterpiece of sound. It's a masterpiece of storytelling. It is, it's the best album. Frankly, it's the best album I've heard in 2024. Again, this is not coming from someone who is a part of the Beehive, who thinks she has had nine classics. No. What makes this album special is the fact that it didn't feel like it was Beyonce spitting, right? So imagine this, right? I've criticized Drake about the fact that Drake has been more concerned about being a pop star, being commercial, being selling records or streams or what have you, than about the actual art of rap, or than the actual out spitting. Like we've seen him spit against his in battles against Meek, Pusha T, and what have you. Drake can spit when he wants to, but that's not what moves the needle. What moves the needle is Drake singing. What moves the needle is Drake, you know, performing for the ladies, sex, his sex appeal. That's what moves the needle. That's why Drake has been the biggest hip hop act over the course of a decade. That's his choice. That's fine. But Drake will never be, to me, in the same conversation as some of the all time great rappers. He just won't be for my, just for that reason alone. In this album, on his album, Beyonce was not performing. It was not a performance to me. It was a, it was her telling a story, track by track by track by track. And it was that storytelling at its highest level. The production, the storytelling. Again, I'm someone, and I listened to her album twice. There are 27 tracks. I think five skit, not skits, but interludes and what have you. So basically 23 tracks of music. I'm someone who opts out once you get past 13 to 15 tracks. That's what I love about Nas. He's efficient. Like Nas does albums, 45 minutes, 50 minutes, and is boom, boom, boom. I say what I gotta say and keep it moving. You can listen to it multiple times in a day, depending on, you know, you work out or your commute or what have you. When an album gets to that 15 or more tracks and 20 or more tracks and things like that, that many tracks, I'm normally out on it. Or I normally have a preconceived notion that I'm probably not gonna listen to this more than a couple times, to be honest with you. That wasn't the case with this album. And again, this album came off to me like a novel, like a book. Like a book and a film. And, you know, it. There were times in the album that I thought that she was going to go in that direction where it was going to turn, where it was going to start to turn into like a performance, like it, like if you witness one of her, I've never been to a concert, but I've watched her concerts, and it was like, and then she would just pull it back and be like, okay, this is a country album. This is a country album. Again, I'm a fan of country music because I listen, you know, we know country music comes from African Americans, the blues and what have you. We understand that. Right? Like, you know, that's the backlash of, you know, it's funny, you know, that's the backlash that she's receiving, the backlash that a lot of black artists who have dealt, you know, who have tapped into country, not tapped in, who have done country have received from the industry and from this, you know, this country, you know, this racist country. But we know where country music comes from. She, again, it seems like she can just do whatever she wants to do as far as any genre of music. You walk away feeling like, damn, Beyonce, if she wanted to do Calypso, could do Calypso. Like if she wanted to do Beethoven, that's how you feel about Beyonce in terms of her ability to, when she focuses in on something, when she locks in on something, puts her mind all the way to it. It's like, what can she not do from an artistry standpoint? This album is a storytelling masterpiece. It is a technical masterpiece. All the features were on point. How the album is arranged, how each song is arranged, it's close to coming to it being a perfect album as you can come. Again, I will remind you, I'm not a part of the Beehive. I'm not. And this album will age, to me, it will age like Kendrick Lamar's last album did, Mr. Morale and the Big Steppers, and like Kanye West's album, Donda. Like, you'll listen to it repeatedly. You might think about it. You might listen to it the first time, be like, okay. But as you keep listening to it over and over, or as the years go by, you will realize that those albums were absolute masterpieces. I mean, both those albums were in conversation, were arguably the best albums of their respective years, 2021 and 2022, back to back. So I'd strongly, strongly recommend this album. I recommend you go back and look at some of the history of blues and country and where it started, and take that journey as well. Because when you start, doing some research, you realize that, again, a lot of these country artists that became popular that were white absolutely took off black country artists who came before them. So black blues performers who came before them. Pure and simple. Pure and as all there is to it. Do you want do please do it. Research it for yourself. Don't just take my word for it. But again, in terms of her best albums, again, I probably would put this second behind Lemonade. Lemonade was a one of the best albums of the decade, up to 2010s. So I'd say Lemonade, this, and then Dangerously in Love. Those would be my top three Beyoncé albums. But this, without question, it's an undeniable classic. This is, I mean, without question, is a classic. And again, Renaissance, I was not as high on Renaissance as a lot of people were. I'm not. Very good album. I don't think Renaissance was great. That's just my personal opinion. Most people, especially if you're in the BI, would certainly disagree with that. And it's going to be interesting to see how this moves culture, how this affects culture. I certainly expect there'll be some more artists that feel more comfortable coming out and doing country music. And I doing country music openly and not being afraid of the backlash or some of the racist shit that they're gonna get. So I think this is gonna this I this is a seminal moment in the culture to me. I think we're gonna look back at this and say, like, this album was a shifter in music culture. I really do. I think that we're gonna look back at it and saying this is one of the most definitive albums of the decade. It's 2024. This will be a definitive album of this decade. When we're approaching 2030, God willing, we will be like looking at this as one of the best albums of the decade. There's no question in my mind. None. Just like we did with Pimp a Butterfly in the 2010s. Kanye's out, Kanye's album. And why is that Twisted Dark Fantasy in the 2010s as well? Though there are certain albums that just that stand out, Illmatic in the 90s, that I Lauryn Hill, I would I'm telling you, we're going to be talking about this album in those same in that same realm. It was that good, that great of an album. It really was. The deep dive. So we get to finally get to men's college basketball. Again, I know there is a men, the men's do have a college basketball. I know I've been kind of shitting on men's college basketball in the last couple of weeks, the past, last month or so. But listen, I mean, look, this is what happens when you have, it's the men's game is not it's not in a great place right now. I mean, perfectly honest with you, you have. The transfer portal, you have you don't have definitive stars in the men's game. That are coming out in the men's game, like, with the personalities, things of that nature. So men's college basketball is an interesting place. But what you do have coming into this Final Four is a team that's on the cusp of a possible of a dynasty in terms of UConn. UConn is seeking this back-to-back national championships. They won a championship this year. They will have six in 25 years. So put that in perspective. Six championships. Put that in perspective. They would be tied with North Carolina for third all time in with most national championships, only behind UCLA's 11 and Kentucky's 8. So this they are in the midst of one of really the quickest dynasty, the really one of the fat. They are probably the fastest historically, the fastest historic blue blood in the history of college basketball. Normally, it takes, you got to go back way back when, those schools like Kentucky, UCLA, North Carolina, those schools, Duke, those schools have been around forever, and of going through a litany of coaches, not litany, but of going through so many different players and all types of tradition to become this, to become blue blood. Blue blood. UConn has become a blue blood basically in 25 years. 20, think about it. From 99 on, they've won five national championships. 99 up to this point. So they've probably become, that without question, the quickest blue blood in the history of college basketball. And they are, the way they're dominating is really, it in this day and age, it's just, I didn't think I'll be, I don't think that we, I could not have anticipated that this was going to happen, because the way, again, you're going to get a situation in college basketball where players are leaving left and right. Coaches are preparing, you know, you're a coach, you know, now you have to prepare in terms of recruits, but you have to be brace yourself in terms of who's leaving that's not going to the NBA, or who's leaving, you know, in terms of the transfer portal and what have you. They are 66 and 11 in the last 2 years, 31 and 1 outside the Big East, and they've had a 30-point lead in every game in this tournament. Think about that for a second. A 30-point lead in every game of this tournament. Last year, they have three guys that go to the NBA. This year, they'll have two for sure: Castle and Klingland. Klingland, who's a center, of course, that was the MOP, not MOP, but the East Region Most Valuable Player, playing great right now. UConn. It's funny with UConn, they, after Calhoun leaves, normally, right, when you lose that legendary coach, it normally takes a while to recover, or normally you don't recover. Like, really, UCLA never recovered from losing John Wooden, per se. Like, I know Jim Harrick won a championship, but, and they've had some good teams in the past where they've gotten to the Final Four, but they really haven't gotten back to that level to where they've been perennial championship team, not ch a perennial championship powerhouse program. Indiana has never recovered from Bob Knight. Louis, I mean, now, and yeah, Indiana hasn't recovered from Bob Knight. We'll see what happens with Duke. North Carolina was fortunate that they had basically one championship coach follow another, in terms of Dean Smith. Like, you had Dean Smith, then Bill Guthridge, who had a short time in North Carolina, but was a great coach and his longtime assistant, and went to back-to-back Final Fours, and was a great, great coach, the late Bill Guthridge. Then they went through what they went through with Matt Daugherty, but they were fortunate that they had somebody like Roy Williams, who was already an established big time coach, that was asked to come home by Dean Smith. And Roy Williams did, you know, had a Hall of Fame career basically at Kansas and North Carolina. But more times than not, you're not recovering from that coach. Like, it will take Syracuse, you know, Syracuse, it will take them decades to recover from losing, you know, them Jim Boeheim retiring. Like, that, it's just not going to happen. I mean, Georgetown has recovered from John Thompson the first. So to see them, you know, Jim Calhoun leaves, they're on the cusp of winning a three championships. Like, is, I mean, you think about it, Jim Calhoun's last year at UConn was, it's up real quick. Jim Calhoun's last year, and Calhoun was certainly one of the great coaches in the history of college basketball in his own right. His last year at UConn was 2012. So from 2012 up until this point, in 12 years, they're on the cusp of winning three championships in 12 years with two different coaches. Like that just doesn't happen. I mean, it just, that does not happen in college sports, in college football or basketball, recovering from losing that legendary coach. You gotta give Bob Hurley all the credit in the world. He, you know, this program was not in great shape when he took it over. You know, we know about what transpired with Kevin Ollie, with some of the recruiting violations. Now they tried to shit on him, but not give him, by not trying to give him his money. That was wrong at the school. But, you know, he had those violations. He comes in the program 2 years, makes it a tournament. You know, not real big. Wasn't a contender the first 2 years, but still made it to a tournament. Year three, wins a championship. And now you're talking about being on the cusp of doing something that hasn't been done since, going back to 2006, 2007 with Florida, led by Billy Donovan. And they go into this Final Four clear the heads and shoulders above everybody as being a favorite. I know Purdue has sides with Edie. I know Alabama has a ton of talent. And Nato's is a very good coach, but you will be shocked. I'd be surprised if not borderline being shocked if Connecticut is not cutting down those nets on Monday night. As far as the NBA goes, we of course are just a couple of weeks away from the playoffs. The MVP is basically locked up with Djokovic out. He's going to win MVP, not so much unanimously, but he's going to win his third MVP. I was watching Denver and San Antonio last night. Fun game to watch. San Antonio has played relatively well the past couple week or so against some good teams. There was a point where Wembanyama was going toe to toe with Jokic, and then Jokic had another gear and just ended up with like 42 and 16, does what he does. But Wembanyama was almost had a quadruple double. You're talking like he has basically 23, 15, 8 assists and 9 block shots. Didn't shoot the ball well from the field, was 9 for 29, but did everything else. Since the All-Star break, Wembanyama is averaging 23, 11 and 4, 23, 11 and 4 blocks a game. He, without question, should be in top three, can finish no less than second in Defensive Player of the Year. Of the year, rookie of the year, is he's going to win that possibly unanimously. And the most impressive thing about him this year to me has been his improvement over the course of the season. We see a lot of rookies come in, even rookies who have excellent rookie seasons. They will start off hot in November and December and then hit a wall because, of course, they're not used to playing that many games around January and February. Since the All-Star break, again, he's gotten stronger and he's improved since the All-Star break as each month has gone by. Case in point, the Knicks, the first time he played the Knicks, he was terrible in that game. That was like in November. So maybe no late November, early December, somewhere it was last year in 2023, I'm for sure. And he was bad in that game. It was a hype game and he just, wet the bed, so to speak. He was terrible. On the his first visit at Madison Square Garden. Fast forward to this past week, I believe it was Sunday. He goes for 40 on a game where Jalen Brunson scores 61. I think it was Friday this past weekend, somewhere Friday or Saturday. I think it was Friday. He has 40 and 20, and they beat the Knicks. A game where Jalen Brunson, of course, had 61 points, 40 and 20. So all the teams that played him the second time, especially on the Eastern Conference, say how much will speak to a man in terms of how much he's improved. And that tells me that he's a hard worker. Like, that tells me that he's not conceding that this season is some shit because the team sucks, or that he probably would have won, and how competitive he is. Because if he doesn't improve, then Chet Holmgren is going to win Rookie of the Year, period. Like, Chet Holmgren would have won Rookie of the Year if he stayed on his track that he was the first couple months of the season. And he wasn't bad the first couple months of the season. He was just extremely inconsistent and still trying to find his way. Now, again, San Antonio right now is a terrible situation as far as how they were using him. They don't know how to pass him the ball. He was playing out of position. He's playing the four instead of the five. The center, him playing the five has changed everything for him. But he has improved every month. And this guy, I'm telling you right now, he without question, he's in conversation to be one of the greatest players of all time. He could be the greatest player in the history of in NBA history. He has that type of potential. And I don't say that. I don't say that often about any player. I didn't say that about LeBron when LeBron came out of high school. Like this dude, I said LeBron thought we could be, we thought he could be a great, great player. But I didn't say that. That man, this dude may end up being the greatest player of all time. No, I didn't. I don't remember. I don't remember hearing that. This guy has a chance to be the greatest player of all time. That's his. That is his ceiling. That is his that is his what his potential. His baseline, at worst, he's a 10-time All-Star, 3 or 4-time Defensive Player of the Year, two or three-time MVP, top 80 when they come out, and, you know, when the NBA comes out with his 80th anniversary team on that team, best player in the world within 2 years. Like, that's his baseline. That's his baseline. This is the worst that you're going to see this dude, these numbers that he's putting up. He's basically putting up, like, for the season, you know, 21, 10, and 3.5 blocks. But he, like, again, he is not unicorn is not even the word. He's a alien. Like, we just never seen a player of this magnitude. And, you know, he has to work on ball handling. Of course, has to get stronger. You know, all he needs is really one go-to post move. That's all he doesn't need. He doesn't need to be Olajuwon in the post or Mikhail. He needs one go-to post move, jump hook, whatever, and it's over. Because what he's going to do defensively is he's going to be probably the second best defensive player of all time behind Bill Russell. I don't see anybody ever, you know, Bill Russell won 11 championships because of the defense he plays. I can't imagine anyone being a better defensive player than Bill Russell. I just can't. This dude can be this generation's Bill Russell, like from that standpoint, in terms of dominance defensively. Not saying he's going to win 11 championships, but from a defensive standpoint, he could dominate the game like, you know, like we've never seen before since Bill Russell. So fun to watch. Again, San Antonio is on the clock for sure. It should not be that hard to build around them. It really shouldn't. You get shooters, you get, you know, guys who can like handle the ball, you know, playmakers and keep it moving. And I think guys are going to want to play with him. He's unselfish. He's an excellent. He's a very underrated passer and a willing passer. He's like, you know, you could throw it into Patrick Ewing, and Patrick Ewing was like a black hole. Like, you never would see the ball. Certain guys don't have that particular skill set. Like, they're not great passers. It's really, like, it's a very unique skill, especially as a big man, to be, to be an average to above average passer. Like, the Jokic of the world, those guys are few and far between. So Rajon Rondo officially retired a couple of days ago. I like when these guys who we haven't seen in a million years retire, and it's like, damn, didn't you? We already thought you were retired to begin with. I mean, Rondo, Carmelo, Iguodala, those have been the guys in the recent couple of years that have retired when they've already been, in essence, retired. But you're going to hear a lot of talk about Rondo and Hall of Fame, and you're going to hear a lot of people say that Rajon Rondo is a Hall of Famer, especially the players. The players, of course, you know, love, you know, all the players. If the NBA players had their druthers, like everybody who's put on a uniform, like 95% of the players who put on a uniform would be in Hall of Fame. Like, everybody's a Hall of Famer amongst the players. Rajon Rondo is not a Hall of Fame. I love Rondo's game. Rondo, his team, he was a winner. His team's in the playoffs. Teams that he played on in the playoffs were 17-8 in playoff series. That's nothing to sneeze about. He was a big reason why his teams were constantly making long runs into the playoffs. He did have series where he outplayed. I've seen him have a series where he outplayed LeBron James. I've seen him have a series where he went toe-to-toe with LeBron James in 2012 and outplayed him in 2010. Okay. I've seen Rondo, you know, in the NBA Finals against the Lakers in 2010, if not, you know, for the Lakers win that series, probably he's the MVP. He's the Finals MVP. Okay. I thought he was a big part of, to be honest with you, I thought he was a big part of the Lakers winning their last championship in 2020. Obviously, you had LeBron and Anthony Davis as their top players, but I thought Rondo was excellent during that playoff run, especially as they got later on you know, got to the finals, Eastern Conference, when they got to the Western Conference Finals and beyond. I really thought he played he kind of stabilized this situation with, you know, taking some pressure off LeBron. So listen, Rondo, I put him in the Hall of very, 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 very good. I really for me to call you a Hall of Fame, first of all, he was an all-star team 4 times, cool, all defensive a couple times. We know he won some assist titles. We also know he used to pad his assist stats at times. That's fine. But when I started thinking about Hall of Fame, to me, you have to be in the conversation at being best at your position at some point in your career. I don't think, you know, Tracy McGrady is a borderline Hall of Famer. He got in, but I probably wouldn't have put him in the Hall of Fame. But at least the argument was, at one point, Tracy McGrady was arguably the best 2-guard in the league, or top 2. You know, there was a conversation with him and Kobe at about 2 years, somewhat. I don't know. I don't think Rondo's ever even been a top 5 point guard in this league, let alone best at his position. So I can't, again, for his career, the numbers don't really tell the story. Like, his numbers are like 11-8 for his career. He's much better than those numbers. But at the same time, he never was anywhere close to being a dominant player at his position. He just wasn't. And Brian, we all know LeBron James loves Rondo. High basketball, high basketball IQ, playoff performer. We also know that his own teammates in Dallas refused to give him his playoff shares as well. So we gotta keep that in mind. As a player, again, he was a very, 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 very good player. I put him in the same category as I would Iguodala, as I would Sean Marion. Neither one of those guys, I feel like, should be in the Hall of Fame. Iguodala will definitely get in. Based off the championships alone, Iguodala will get in. Marion might get in. I wouldn't put him in the Hall of Fame either. So, you know, that's just my opinion in terms of that. He was an excellent player. I think Rondo would, you know, I could see him coaching one day. I absolutely could see him coaching someday. Again, just a talented playmaker, excellent defensively, and was absolutely fearless. He had no fear. He could be competing against Kobe, LeBron, whoever. Had zero fear of anybody that was on the court. And then when he's with the big three in Boston, had no fear of them as a young player. No, none. So I think he's had an excellent career, but not a Hall of Fame. Just not, I think, just not that, just not dominant enough. Again, not best, not top, you know, not a top player at his particular position. Who won the week? I would have to say we had a lot of candidates. It was a good week for a few people. I have to say the NC State, North Carolina State Wolfpack, DJ Burns here, who was the MOP of the region, of the West region. Excuse me, not the West region, of the South region, as they beat Duke. And I did take some, even though North Carolina lost, I did take some joy in Duke losing, to be honest with you. North Carolina State makes their first Final Four since 86 or 83. It had been going back to Jim Valvano. It might have been their first regional final since 86. It was a team. I watched North Carolina State because I watched the NCAA. I watched the ACC tournament this year closely. They wouldn't even been in the tournament had they not beat North Carolina. Like, even though that win over the Duke was not enough. So they had to win that tournament just to make it to the NCAA tournament. And they got there and just completely took off. And they are the epitome of a Cinderella. The ACC is always great when you have – it's been rare when all three of those teams were good to great in terms of the North Carolina, North Carolina State, Duke, and North Carolina State. So, obviously, a huge for that program to get back to the Final Four. They have a lot of shooting. We know what DJ Burns can do. I know the NFL is trying to, you know, possibly get him, you know, get a look at in terms of the NFL, but I feel like if he drops about 30 pounds, that he could be a serviceable NBA player. He has a lot of skill, footwork, you know, some inside moves. I think he could. I think he could have a serviceable career in the NBA if he were, you know, if he went that route. But yeah, North Carolina State absolutely won the week. You think about their last couple of weeks. You know, they have two wins over North Carolina. I mean, a win over North Carolina and two wins over Duke, and had to win every single one of those games in order to get to where they are at right now. And listen, I think, you have UConn. You know, look at the Final Four. UConn, Alabama. Alabama has a lot of weapons. I watch North. They can score with anybody. They're gonna have to make a zillion threes to stay in the game with UConn. They really are. They're gonna have to be. They're going to absolutely dominate that 3-point line in order to have a chance in that game. I could see that game being close for a half, but UConn just kind of wears on you over the course of 40 minutes. I expect them to pull away like in the second half. That the North Carolina State Purdue game, I actually like North Carolina State. I'm still not sold on Purdue, to be perfectly honest with you. I think North Carolina State, I think DJ Burns could bring Edie out, to be honest with you, could bring him out as far on the perimeter. North Carolina State can also get hot from the 3-point range. And North Carolina State is the more is battle tested. They're not afraid of anyone. They played in the ACC, proved to be better than what people expected. You see, Clemson, Duke, and North Carolina State get to Elite Eight. You see four teams, North Carolina including that, get to the Sweet 16. So the ACC has had a big tournament, to say the least, when the ACC was getting shit on over the course of this regular season. I know what happened to Virginia in the first four, but whatever. Come tournament time, the ACC performed extremely well. So North Carolina State is battle tested. They beat Alabama. Not beat, no, they didn't beat Alabama, but North Carolina State, again, played a decent schedule and again, played in within the conference. We know what they did within the conference, especially late. I don't, again, I'm not in love with, I just, I'm not in love with Purdue. I just don't. I know Edie's excellent on the college game and at the college level will be a serviceable pro because of his size. I wouldn't take him as a lottery pick, though. I heard that. I like, no, nah, I'm good. He maybe late first round, early second. I'm not taking him as a lottery pick. But I like North Carolina State in the game. So I think come Monday night, you have North Carolina State and UConn. And again, I'd be hard pressed to see anybody else outside of UConn cutting down the nets. That's going to wrap it up for this latest edition of the Real Deal Podcast. Enjoy your evening and the rest of your week. So long.